Congratulations!
You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts. Hang on.
You can't say that?
The Bay's number two arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
Maysoon. Mm-hmm. I think we made some kind of pledge or promise or something.
To not ask people.
In an earlier episode, to not be asking people, what are you up to? What shows do you have coming up? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I had a performance thing I did at ZOEX. And one of the people in the audience, one of the people in the audience was somebody I knew who's an undergrad student somewhere. And I was so high after the thing from like doing performance stuff and being so like revved up on adrenaline and cortisol or whatever the fuck. So I was so fucked up that I was just like, oh, do you have shows coming up? Blah, 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 blah. And this person is an undergrad.
So like, of course
they're
you
just
don't
doing
have.
Their trying to get their finals done.
Uh-huh.
Poor person.
What do they say? They're like,
oh,
no, asshole.
I'm just doing
I'm
my
just
homework.
I'm just finishing school.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, and like, as I was saying it, I'm like, I'm the dick of the world right now. And then I was like, or like anything you're excited about, like lectures or anything, I could come.
You can thank Lionel like, for that, listeners.
Oh, my God. Like lectures or, you know, I tried to like spin it into like, are there any other events coming up that maybe the point was I wanted to see her again.
Yeah.
You know, like I just wanted to be able to chit chat and like if she was having a show, I could come to the show and we could chit chat longer. That was the whole damn point of me saying.
Why don't you just email her and say, hey, come to this lecture with me. Let's
no,
hang
right.
Out.
But I can't go back in time and unsay like, oh, you got any shows coming up?
You can't undick yourself.
That was the
That's
thing.
True.
Because I'm sure whatever, if she had something coming up, we do email. So like, it was just like a
it's
huge
okay.
faux pas.
We all make that
mistake.
Thank you. I'm like, wait, what a second.
Oh my god. Well, how have you been doing on your pledge?
Oh, good, very good.
You
listen, man. I was the worst person at that. I was always asking artists, "How you doing? You got any shows up? What are you working on?"
Yeah.
And then I think I started to, you know, just finally realize, no, you just got to cut it out. Artists don't want to fucking talk about that. Let them bring it up. It's stressful.
Right. Yeah. So I apologize. We have to start the month over now because okay. I fucked it up. I got to restart.
We're entering into a new astrological sign.
Oh, okay.
We're going to be entering into Taurus soon.
Oh, that's good.
Is Taurus good?
I think Taurus is a little more mellow, but yeah. Stubborn.
Stubborn nonetheless.
May Day is coming up.
Hey,
May 1st. A lot of protests and actions happening.
Yeah.
I know there's going to be some, I think...
So we'll have information on that. We'll have some information on what's happening in the arts and the arts here in the Bay Area, a few arts organizations and some new news.
And I forget if I linked to it in our last episode, but that panel we talked about, the Who We Be, the super panel on art and activism.
Totally.
That the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism put on a couple weeks ago. The audio of that is now publicly available. So
I
I'll
think
have
you linked to it. But
so
maybe not.
There's a link to that down in the underworld. Please listen to that. Here's a little clip of something Ben Davis said that I thought was the most like, maybe we'll talk about this on the next episode.
We wanted to come away from here with something, one meaningful thing that we could do as an arts community, just really concretely, would be don't take money from real estate. Yeah. Like, no pop-up show as a moose-boosh for a luxury transformation. I mean, that's a very concrete thing people could do to build solidarity. It's the needed solidarity.
We're here at beautiful Thrills College in Oakland, California, talking to the host of the actual number one arts and culture podcast, Nia King, host of We Want the Airwaves, also author of Queer and Trans Artists of Color, a full-on book. Long story short, can you tell us a little bit about your podcast, which everyone should be listening to?
I run a podcast called We Want the Airwaves, where I interview queer and trans artists of color about their lives and their work. The book was actually co-edited by two friends that I met at Mills, Jessica Glennon-Zukoff and Tara Michelson, and we interviewed 16 artists, mostly Bay Area based, but not completely. There's Janet Mock is in there. She's probably the most well-known. She's New York based. Rika Aoki based in LA. Fabian Romero based in Olympia, and then two Chicago-based artists, Kian Marcelo Junio, and then Van Binfo is also Chicago. But then everyone else in the book is Bay Area-based, like San Francisco, El Cerrito, Berkeley, Oakland.
It's really good. Everyone should go get it. You can get it at a lot of places. Pegasus.
Yeah, especially locally. Pegasus Books in downtown Berkeley and the one in Rockridge has it. Diesel Books in Rockridge also has it. And Modern Times in SF. Sometimes Show and Tell in downtown Oakland also has it.
We had another podcaster ask us what we've learned over the course of time that we've been doing it. And obviously you do like intense research about the people you interview. So I was wondering if you had any tips or if you had any, like, you know, what was your kind of revelations that came to you from doing it for so long?
I mean, I think my worst habit is I don't mic myself. Like, my mic only faces one direction, and so I almost always have it facing towards the artist. And that's just, like, I think it started because I was shy, and then I don't know. It's just a really bad habit that I have from podcasting.
Do you write a script?
Oh, yeah. Do you, like, write? Well, I mean, it's just questions. So would you, like, write your questions down on paper?
I did in the beginning. Yeah. I mean, I've done, like, not to brag, but I've done, like, over 40 interviews now. So in the beginning, I stuck very strictly to the script because I was very nervous and very shy. And then as I've gotten more comfortable doing it, I tend to shoot from the hip a lot more. I might write down a couple questions, but not like a whole script.
Yeah. It's hard to pick and hard to like single out any people. But like, are there interviews that you feel like have gone, you know, really, really well or like surprised you?
I was just talking with a friend about this the other day. Sometimes it takes a while to get to or to figure out what's sort of like interesting about a person. Sometimes the thing you think is going to be interesting turns out that there's just not that much there, or what they have to say about it isn't that interesting. And sometimes people just like in the first couple of seconds just kind of like lay it all on the table. And the most recent interview I posted with artist Indira Allegra, she talked pretty early on in the podcast about she was working like full time or maybe freelancing or both as a ASL interpreter, and she started losing her hearing. And I thought that was super interesting. And the way she figured out she was losing her hearing is because one of her deaf clients asked her, like, while she was translating, are you lip reading right now? And like, what an intense way to figure out, to find out that you're losing your hearing when you didn't know that and are working, you know, in the field of like deaf access and deaf and ASL translation. That's happened a fair amount on the podcast. Like, I've had people come out as sex workers that I didn't know were sex workers, or as survivors of, you know, types of violence or homelessness that I didn't know they had any experience with. And I don't know, shit gets real.
I remember in the interview with Persia and Daddy's Plastic, learning that they all had this interest, like I think almost all of them had a background that had some kind of intense religious upbringing.
Yes. And they all talk about that in the book as well.
Yeah, that was a really intense one.
How's the reception been of the book since you've had it out?
I know that they're using it in a class here at Mills. Oh, it's cool. Been incorporated into a curriculum.
Yeah, Priya Kandaswamy, one of my former professors, is using it in Intro to Queer Studies, which I couldn't be happier or more proud about. She's one of my favorite professors here. The reception has been really positive. I mean, all the reviews have been very kind. I'm fortunate to have a number of friends who are other women of color that work in media at places like Bitch and Autostraddle and Lambda Literary that were able to provide positive press for the book. Yeah, so far, as far as I know, none of the reviews have been negative, but I keep waiting for that other boot to drop. it really depends, but so far I figure I'll cross that bridge when I get there. I think some of the not negative feedback, but like I have a survey out that I try to get listeners to, because I don't really get a lot of feedback on the podcast, where I try to collect feedback through like SurveyMonkey. And some of the feedback I've gotten is like, I wish there were more mixed folks on the podcast. I wish there were more femmes on the podcast. I wish there were more elders on the podcast. And I thought that was really interesting because I feel like there actually are a lot of those, but they don't necessarily always talk about being femme or being mixed or being,
they're not like identifying themselves as such through the podcast.
Yeah, hard to know.
Yeah, but I think if you read the book, you'll definitely notice like a lot of people talk about being femme or their gender identity or things like that. Even though I don't ask questions, I try not to ask identity-based questions and really focus on their work and honor the work.
I was also noticing that you've been doing a lot of speaking gigs or reading gigs.
You're going on tour.
Yeah, you're going on tour. You are very soft-spoken and, as you said, maybe a little bit shy. How's that going? I think I'd be a nervous wreck.
I'd be shitting myself.
I think it gets easier the more you do it. I definitely stress out in advance, but I also... bad habit is that I don't like to prepare.
It's not happening, and then it's happening. You're like, okay, I just got to do it now.
Yeah, or it's even less logical than that. It's like, if I don't prepare, then I can't forget anything. I used to be a lot more nervous and shy about public speaking, and I took an improv class at the Pan Theater in downtown Oakland, and that super helped with public speaking. So at this point, like, public speaking is hard when you don't know what you're talking about. Since I pretty much exclusively talk about my work, it's not that hard. I really enjoy what I do. I'm really proud of these interviews, and I could talk about their stories and these people and why their work matters all day.
that helps a lot.
What's your you went to Mills. What did you study here? How did you get into this field?
Yeah, so I transferred in. Well, I'm gonna go back a ways to answer your question. So straight out of high school, I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore for illustration.
Micah.
Yes, Micah. I dropped out after one semester, moved back home, was like living on my grandma's couch for a while and working at Pete's Coffee. And then I saved up some money, traveled across the U.S., really liked Denver, moved there for a year, went back to school for social work, was there for a year, and then moved again out here and transferred to Mills. And so I finished my degree in ethnic studies here at Mills. But it was a sort of circuitous way of getting my degree, I suppose.
I read in an interview with you in the East Bay Express that was kind of part of starting this project, was being a student in ethnic studies and trying to find, you know, research or writing about queer artists of color, and that there was like next to nothing out there.
Yeah, there was really just one book called Disidentifications by Jose Esteban Munoz, who unfortunately passed away a year or two ago. And it's a really important book. I'm really glad that it exists, but it's also like extremely academic and difficult to read. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to build on that, but also to create an alternative that was a little bit more accessible and, you know, meant for a not necessarily academic audience.
That was really weird that they had like weird antiquated search terms that you had to use to even look that stuff up.
Yeah, Michael Bell, who's a really, really, really amazing librarian here, is very dear to my heart. When I was looking for stuff and getting really frustrated, he was saying like, well, you know, the system is kind of old. And so the term, I mean, like queer and trans and people of color are all sort of neologisms, I guess, right? Like even from coast to coast, I feel like I've been trying to work. I'm going on tour, as you mentioned recently. I'm going back to Boston, which is where I'm from, and organizing events in New York and Philly, the other cities I'm going to, has been relatively easy. But in Boston, it's really hard to tap into a QPOC community, and I'm not sure that it really, QPOC being queer people of color, exists there the way it does here, in terms of like, you know, Boston historically is sort of famously segregated. And so out here, where I feel like there's sort of a pan-ethnic QPOC identity, where like queer people of color from all different races and ethnicities sort of come together under that umbrella to organize. In other cities, especially on the East Coast, I feel like you don't see that as much. You might have like queer Dominicans or queer Nigerians or, you know, queer Vietnamese folks, but not necessarily all organizing together under that sort of like QPOC umbrella, if that makes sense.
Art and activism, even though they often are like so closely tied, there's also sometimes, I don't know, friction between activist groups and the art world, because the art world, especially at the institutional level, is like overwhelmingly white, affluent population. But I mean, your work, obviously, like having a book is much different than like a painting in a gallery. And you also make zines. And I mean, that must be a conscious decision.
I mean, it's funny. Like I draw comics. That's kind of my main. Before I started doing more journalistic type like interviews and podcasting and the book, comics were my main sort of creative output. And comics have always been considered low art. That's like sort of slowly changing, but always intended to be really accessible, sort of similar to graffiti or other stuff that's just meant to be like easily accessed and consumed by people on the street, you know, outside the hallowed halls of the art institution, the art world. And so I really feel like I know almost nothing about high art and have developed sort of a stubborn resistance to the idea even of high art. Because I feel like the kind of art that queer and trans people of color are doing, often they're low income, often they're, you know, maybe dropped out of school, or, you know, even some of the people in this book have PhDs, some of them dropped out of college, and there are a lot that are sort of in between. Like, what we do is never really considered, like, white people have gotten to define what's considered art in the U.S. since colonization of this land. And so it feels sometimes like whatever we do is never going to be considered real art or fine art, so why not embrace, like, trash? And I think that's something I heard. I'm a huge fan of Love and Rockets, which is a comic by Los Bros Hernandez, Jaime and Gilberto and Mario, to a lesser extent. And I heard them speak at the Latino Comics Expo in San Jose fairly recently. And they, one of the things, I wish that I could remember exactly what they said, but that really stuck with me, was about embracing trash as a platform for your art, as like a foundation for your art. And it was kind of like, yeah, like if people consider what we do to be trash anyway, why not embrace trash instead of sort of like trying to, you know, break down the walls of the art institutions? Let's just do our own thing on the outside and have a big trash party.
I love that.
Are you embracing comics more now at this moment?
I like comics. I love the Hernandez brothers.
Okay. Maysoon likes to make fun of me because I also do comics, but I know it's all in jest and just to really upset me.
So what's the joke?
Is that Maysoon will be like, oh, are you doing comics or are you doing real work? And then I'll be like, God damn you, Maysoon.
I'm making the like low art, high art, obnoxious joke.
She owns a lot of comics, so I give her a pass.
Yeah, we have like tons of graphic novels in the house, all of like Love and Rockets, the whole stack, Palomar, everyone, you know?
But do you consider it real art? Do you think of it as real art?
Yeah.
But that's a different question, whether you love it or not.
I do consider it real art.
Would you say that this is another contentious issue on the podcast that maybe you now can settle for us? Would you consider food the art of the mouth?
Sorry.
See what I'm saying?
I think cooking food is an art. I think presenting food is an art. I'm not sure exactly what you mean about the art of the mouth. That's kind of where it goes to be disposed of. That's where it becomes trash. So would that make this like the art of the ear?
Kind of.
Would that be music or both? Is that an artificial distinction that we've drawn to separate art from
very arbitrary?
Yes. High art from low art, podcast versus music.
I have an issue. I live in the Mission District in San Francisco. There are 500 new fucking restaurants opening up every day. And I just, like, to me, it's like so emblematic of what's happening in the neighborhood, gentrification. It's like everything else. There's no room for any kind of cultural institution. Like, no bookstores can, like, bookstores barely survive. Galleries can't survive. Any kind of creative cultural centers are all having a hard time. So when I see these restaurants popping up and it's just like
$900 bagel,
tons of money on some fucking fancy ass cocktails and like whatever, pigs in a sock or whatever, fancy style. What are they called?
Pigs in a blanket.
You know what I mean? Like, there's such like this fetish around food right now, and it just like, and it's like, I don't know, the money and like the culture around it just drives me, it just drives me nuts. And so for me, I'm like, I can't talk about food as culture right now or as art. I just can't do it.
Well, that's interesting, because I think so let's say food is art, then there's high art, high food art, which is what you're talking about, and then there's low food art, which is everything else. And I think food is definitely art and like a means of communication, but I feel like what you're talking about is not specific to food. It's just sort of manifesting that way in the Mission District right now. Yes. Because, and Google is responsible for folks that don't live in the Bay Area or haven't had this conversation like 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Google is directly responsible for the hyper gentrification that's taking place in the Mission District specifically, as well as Twitter. But yeah, it's about the sort of like artisanalification of everything. Because I don't think it's just food. It's like, you know, boutique clothing and boutique stationery and boutique, like, you know, handmade furniture and whatever. Like, yeah. Like all of those things. It's the fact that they're charging so much for them and trying to, I don't know. I don't think food, like, what's art is so subjective, oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. I mean, that's super obvious to say, but like it's not the idea of food as art that turns me off because of gentrification. It's the idea that like the pupuserias and taquerias that always existed in the Mission are not art, but these new places are, and therefore we should be willing to pay I feel like it's similar to like, why would we pay a lot of money for some art but not other? Like, we've decided as a culture that this has value and that this doesn't. Mm-hmm. But they're objectively not different and maybe don't even cost that much different to make.
Love it. I love it. I agree completely.
I still don't want to bring a fancy chef on the show.
I never wanted a fancy chef on the show, Maysoon. What fancy chef do we even know? Okay, I really love that you're settling some long-standing issues of the podcast for us. Do you have an opinion on the Bay versus LA?
I've heard that LA is cheaper.
God damn it.
I mean, I love the Bay, but it's a very difficult, very expensive. It's a very difficult place for a low-income person to live. I mean, gentrification is happening everywhere, but the Bay, you can't ignore it. It's just in your face all the time. Especially, like, as someone who works a minimum wage job, I'm thinking about displacement and how my own displacement is impending just all of the time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that would be different in LA, but I'd like to think that it's different somewhere.
Toledo, Ohio.
I wanted to ask how you go about sort of selecting the artists that you're talking to, that you interview on your podcast.
I mean, it started with who I know. And actually, I would like to address this since I'm here. One of the things that's sort of a, I don't know if I would call it a disadvantage, but like a result of having gone to a women's college, as a queer person that went to a women's college, is that when I graduated, my social network was like pretty exclusively, not completely exclusively, but like very heavily queer cis women and transgender men. And so I didn't want the podcast to only represent that demographic, and I pretty actively seek out transgender women and cisgender men, gay men to interview. But it's challenging because like when I think of like who's easy to get, it tends to be people I already know or people that know people I already know. And that has been sort of largely shaped by like the community that I built while I've been living in Oakland and while I was here. And then after I did this book, I realized that it was very heavily Black and Latino. There's only like two or three Asian artists in there, and two artists that are half Indigenous. And the second year I've tried to focus, well, I guess I'm in the third year now. In the second year I tried to focus really heavily on East Asian, South Asian, Arab, and Indigenous folks, and ended up with a decent number of East Asian, South Asian, and like maybe one or two Arab folks, but I'm still always looking for more Indigenous folks to have on the podcast and trans women of color. Those are definitely my priorities, but you know, it's a combination of like whose work I'm excited about, who I know, who I can get, and then also reaching out to find out. Like I know a lot of queer and trans artists of color that curate other queer and trans artists of color. Yeah. And so being like, so who do you know? Like who are some queer Arab artists doing exciting work mm-hmm. right now?
Oh, that was another question, because we work in tandem as a two-person single organism. And you... There is. It's like a chimera.
Okay. We work as a chimera.
Maybe not. I don't know. We should look that up before we go saying that.
I thought that was the name of the, like, super lethal virus in one of the Mission Impossible movies.
It was. It was. Yep. So you do your podcast pretty much solo. I mean, you have the people you interview, but you're doing like all the work, huh?
Yeah, except for the transcription. I do it all myself. I have a number of friends that help me with transcription, and that's the biggest ongoing expense for the podcast. So the first couple of years, I was crowdfunding a lot to cover the cost of transcription so that the podcast could be available to deaf and hard of hearing audiences. And now, fortunately, through Patreon, I'm receiving enough funds that the podcast is paying for itself, and I'm no longer losing money and actually starting to make a little bit of money, which is very exciting. It's taken like three years to start to sort of break even off of art stuff, but I'm glad that it's happening.
Oh yeah, get on there and donate, listeners, and listen to the podcast. You obviously like podcasts. But I was going to say, because you do the podcast pretty much solo, but then on the book you were kind of working with editors. I was wondering kind of what that shift was like, if it was like marked at all.
I mean, it's hard. Working with friends is always hard. My co-editors are really great, but it's very hard for someone that's used to doing everything themselves to learn how to delegate and like relinquish control and trust. Trust that they maybe know more about some aspects of like English grammar and punctuation than I do. That was a big source of tension in our relationship at a certain point. I think they did an amazing job. I think they're a huge part of the reason why the book is so good. It's because it's really well edited and really like carefully, lovingly, meticulously edited.
Is there anything else that you would like listeners to know?
support my work, please. Support queer and trans artists of color. A lot of the artists that I feature in my work are very slept on, and I'm trying to change that. And I want, you know, the broader, I say that, like, we're just going to have this trash party on the outside, but really my hope is that, like, people that have access to resources will start to understand the value of our work and support us in monetary and institutional ways. So check out the artists in the book and on the podcast and support their work, support my work, and Cutie Pock Art saves lives.
And as always, congratulations. And thank you so very much for coming out here and talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I gotta say that last week I forgot to say any of our contact information on the show.
Oh my which God.
If you listen to the show, you know that that is a complete rarity, but somehow I edited out every time I said any way to contact us. And yet we got more listener feedback
than ever before. Yep.
So maybe I should stop saying how to contact us and people will get more interested wanting to reach us.
Because you're not prodding them constantly?
Maybe people are just kind of, you know, have that oppositional defiance disorder.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, anyhow, point is, we got some listener questions and listener feedback this week. So a couple shout-outs. Shout-out to Nilly Gill.
Nilly Gill, woo!
And then we got an email in from Jesse asking us about auctions where they have artists give their work to an institution for free for the place to sell to make money for the place, fundraising auctions.
Yeah.
Maysoon, break it down.
Well, I guess I know a few places that have auctions.
Seems like every damn place does.
Every damn place has auctions. That's true for the most part. A lot of the places I know of personally, though, offer a percentage back to the artists if they want it. So you can either donate your work 100% for free or I think get, I want to say up to 20 or 30% back from the sale.
Yeah.
I think there are options. I think if you're an artist who wants to get something back, you probably shouldn't be donating to auctions that aren't giving you that where there's no option to get anything back.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think in general, as an artist, you should be really specific about which auctions you give to, which sort of places you want to align yourself with.
Yeah.
You know, even as an emerging artist, you don't have to give your work to every single person who asks you for it.
Have discretion and, you know, fight for yourself. Like, this isn't going to be your Guggenheim Fellowship, you know.
Right.
Like, so, an auction might not be the place where somebody's going to come and discover you and, you know, rip you up out of obscurity.
But an auction is a place where you might, a collector might discover you and might pursue buying works from you in the future.
But see, now isn't that kind of once we say that, aren't we kind of like we're kind of conning the artist into the auction being like you're getting exposure?
I think you are getting exposure, just like I think you're getting exposure in a juried show. But I don't think we should con artists into you know giving their work away for free. But I'm just saying there are elements or there are multiple things to consider, I guess, when giving your work to anything. You know, like a SOEX auction, there's a lot of people that go to those.
So that it's
like,
is, and if, that if was you, hot times.
So to some degree, you could give, but SOEX also gives money back to artists if you want it.
Right.
So there's a form you fill out and you check the box that says, I want, you know, 20% back or it's an absolute donation.
I just know when Helena Keefe does that project where you're figuring out, should I work for free or
I love
not?
That chart. We should try to find that and post it.
Uh-oh. Bad news, you guys. This is Kate from the future letting you know that actually that chart, turns out that was made by Jessica Hishy. Links to everything in the underworld.
But it's basically like when you should work for free and when you shouldn't work for free.
Basically,
and it's
like is a person your friend?
Yes or no.
And do you owe them a proverbial kidney, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But kind of the bottom line was like, no, you shouldn't really work for free.
Yeah, it was basically, I think all routes led to no. For the most part, there might have been one route that led to yes.
And
fine.
Then I know there was another part too, where it's like, you know, if you're some kind of institution trying to raise money, have a cakewalk. I don't know. It's kind of one of those things where, although I would never have a problem with like giving a little something to like a little art thing, because I know my studio has, I have plenty of shit that I could give away. I could see the opposition being that these places that are supporting artists shouldn't be putting like part of their financial burden on the artists, because like you're giving your work. And if you believe that your work has value, then you're giving money away. Like you're giving however many hundreds of dollars you could have had selling that work.
Would you rather just be asked for a monetary donation?
Support the places? No, I don't know. I wouldn't have any problem putting work in a thing like that. Especially at the SOEX one, then you get to come to the thing for free.
The really crazy party where it's way too crowded.
And you can get those. Last time they had little tamales. That's another one where it's kind of, I can see why people would object to it. I could see why it still goes on forever. What do you think, listener? Find out how to contact us and let us know. I'm not going to tell you. Another listener feedback we got in was a call on the line.
A call on the line.
On the call. We got a call from the call line.
Hi there, Kate. This is your pal, Rob, from United Kingdom. And you were talking to me soon this week about the problem of video art and how if you go in to see like a video installation at a gallery, like it's halfway through or it's on a loop and you might want to start it from the beginning or something, but your idea of a red button, that is the most ludicrous idea I've ever thought of, like a reset button that you would hit. Or Maysoon had this idea that you would use a remote control. No, all you need is outside the screening room, you need a little countdown that tells you when the video is going to start. Okay, because that is the most frustrating thing. If you go in to see some video art and it tells you, you just walk in there and there's someone else sat there. And so you feel like you've got to sit around until something comes up on screen that you've already seen. And you go, okay, well, I've seen the whole thing now. No, you just need a counter outside that says, in 2 minutes, we're going to start again. And then you're golden. And okay, the other rule that I'm going to institute, right, is that if the video is longer than, like, say, 10 minutes, okay, you've got to put it on the internet. That's the rule. It's got to be on the internet. And you've got to have a link outside that tells you, like, how to watch it on your phone or something. Because I went to a gallery recently to see this video or whatever, and it was, like, 50 minutes long playing on a loop. What the heck am I supposed to do? Just sit outside the screening room, like, watching my clock for 50 minutes till it's ready to start again? No, crazy. Put it on Vimeo. Everyone can watch around the globe. Idiots like me can watch it in England.
Well, I think that was a good idea. People actually already do that. I've seen videos like that where there's a countdown clock on the outside.
Like, okay, yeah.
And I think that could be effective, but I just feel like, I think Rob is thinking more of like the black box viewing situation. I was kind of thinking more of like when you pop the headphones on and you're the only one watching.
Oh, I was thinking black box too.
Oh, okay. Well, I was thinking either of those. I mean, I feel like I've been in a black box where I was the only one there many times.
Right. So I guess Rob's theory of the countdown situation, that would work in a scenario where there are people already in the room, which I didn't even think about yet.
What do you mean?
Well, I just assumed you were showing up at the museum or gallery and there was no one else watching.
Right.
And well, so then you could just reset. But you can't just reset something
if there's other people in there watching. Well, I was hoping that the button would be with the screen. Like you were saying outside, like a history museum or something. But then your buttons are right there. You've got your button in front of you. The screen's in front of you. If you're in the middle of it,
I think for like in the gallery kind of viewing, not in a black box viewing, I think that would be good.
Yeah. I think it's good everywhere.
A reset.
I still like my idea better than the countdown clock. Because if there's no one in
there. Here's the deal with the countdown clock.
Yeah.
I like the idea. I get it. I think it's good for museums where there's a lot of people already in there. And those are never museums I seem to be in. For some reason, they're certainly not the ones I seem to work in.
Right.
You know, it's not the SF MoMA. It's not Guggenheim, whatever.
Yeah.
The comment I made to Kate earlier was that this guy doesn't know Americans, obviously.
He does.
He doesn't.
What do you think Americans are going to do? Like, they rip don't the clock wait. Down off they the don't wall wait like for shit on it?
They just don't want to wait. Americans are like immediate, instant gratification. Yeah. They want to go in, they want to watch 3 minutes, and they want to turn around and leave.
Soon, I beg to differ. Remember when Christian Marclay's The Clock was playing at SF MoMA? People were waiting in line for hours. It's just got to be hot enough from a big enough celebrity art star. It's got to be
hot enough. And that project was definitely hot enough.
That was a hot one. It's a hot hottie. Okay, then the other thing was, what about putting shit on the internet? There's like a whole, there's a whole code of ethics about putting your shit on the internet. Like,
I think that's so specific to the artist. I mean, really.
Like in school, talking about video stuff, I had professors say, like, just you shouldn't put, maybe you put like a trailer, a clip or something on the internet, but you should never put the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a bigger deal for people that if you're like, have like a budget, like you're spending like $10,000 on making, or however much, that to me is a lot, but that's small for like a big production. Mm-hmm. Then you don't want to just be putting that out for free.
Yeah.
But I put all my shit up for free.
Right. That's because you don't care.
But I don't, yeah, and I hardly spend any money making it. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, maybe some pieces are for the artists, at least. Maybe they're really meant to be seen in a very specific environment and way. And, you know, YouTube isn't going to provide that at all times.
Right.
Or isn't going to be the most appropriate.
We got a tweet in from a listener who also happens to be my brother.
Brother Skid.
Specifically to me and Maysoon, what is our criteria for what makes good art? Okay, 5 minutes on the clock. Because we could go on obviously about this for a whole 500 episodes. We're just going to spend 5 minutes.
I actually think this question is pretty difficult to answer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I don't know if I have like a list of criteria for
I do.
Good
Here's
art.
My three kinds of art that I like. Number one, paintings or photographs of houses from a very frontal view. I like frontal images of houses.
Wow.
Number two, pictures or paintings of the ocean with or without boats in it. I don't care. Boats are fine. Number three, monologues by women. Angry monologues and manifestos yelled or said by women.
Uh-huh.
Like Karen Finley has a monologue she does, you know, where she like takes all her clothes off and she takes an Easter basket with real eggs in, dumps them all into a bag with like stuffed rabbits and shit, and like slams it on the ground and then takes it out, takes the bunny out, wipes the broken eggs all over her body, and then puts gold leafing on her body, like gold foil that mm-hmm. she puts up in the air and like puts all over her body, and then like a rainbow streamer around her neck, and then does this speech where she like basically is like imitating like a hysterical woman.
And I go down to Wall Street. Oh, I go into the stock exchange and I cut off your balls. You don't miss your balls. Oh, you're too busy fucking me with everything else you got. Oh, you're too busy fucking me with everything else you got. Oh, you don't bleed, only dollar signs come out of you.
And you know Andrea Fraser and
oh yeah, I know
any I love
any ranting and
spoken
raving.
Word
really
by women artists, yeah, anything where by the end of it I'm like fuck, or like I'll cry. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I guess I for like I do not have that kind of criteria at all.
Obviously,
I feel very confused.
There's a lot that I like outside of those three, but those three pretty much, if you make any of those three things, you can't miss with me.
Wow. I guess I respond mostly to work that I have. I mean, I like work that I have a really strong response to, whether or not it's like a hate or, you know, I have a strong reaction to it. Uh-huh. That sort of makes me want to think more about what it is, what that reaction is, what the work is about, what caused that reaction. But in general, I like any medium. It's not like a specific, I only like painting, I only like photography. Uh-huh. I tend to really like installation, large scale installation, site specific installations.
Okay. I also like art that is self-conscious. I like art that's kind of meta. I think mm-hmm. that's why I like John Hirschman's videos a lot, because mm-hmm. they're like, you know, aware of themselves.
Yeah.
Things like that. You like work that has a political
I definitely
consciousness.
Do. Mm-hmm.
Oh, too late. Anyhow, thanks so much, everybody, for calling in. I had it to the grapevine.
Congratulations.
You listened to another episode of Congratulations Pine Tree. Next week, we'll have a show up.
What the
Just fuck? Like last week and this week.
Next week, you can ask Kate what she's working on.
Should we tell the contact info?
Nah.
Okay, don't you dare call it, but the number is 419-351-6606 or at Pine Tree Podcast on Twitter. You can call or text that number, or don't. You better not.
Don't do it, listeners.
And also, if anybody wants to have us say any things they got coming up on next month's ramble, just go ahead and send those in.
Send those in.
It doesn't have to be something you're doing or in or anything, just maybe something you're excited about.
Yeah.
So, have a great week. And
don't fuck up this week, everyone. Down, down, easy. Let it down, down, right now. Let it down.